Strangers is made possible in part by Betterment, an online investment manager designed to transform the way you invest. Over 30,000 customers are already investing with Betterment to optimize returns, save time, and minimize taxes. Upgrade your investment approach with Betterment's cutting-edge technology by visiting betterment.com/strangers.
Welcome to Strangers. I'm Leah Tao. And you know, when you produce a program called Strangers, people often say, oh, about the people we meet and fateful encounters, things like that. And I say, well, it's also about the ways we can be strangers to ourselves or to the people we thought we were closest to. It's about the transformations we go through and the strange places we travel to. So it's really much broader than that. But sometimes it is about a fateful encounter. And today's story is one of those. It's about two people who meet in a random place at a random time and wind up affecting each other's lives in a major way. It is also about how far we'll go to help another.
I'm Cora Layton. I'm a professor at Berkeley City College. I have a PhD in communication, but 11 years ago, I was living in LA and getting my MA and working as a stripper, trying to maintain my life as a grad student and my life as a stripper and my life as a cocaine addict, all these various lives that didn't seem to fit well together. A lot of people started dying. You know, my coworker died in a car crash. My cousin died in a motorcycle accident. A good friend committed suicide. And it was like 9 people in 6 months. And then my sort of boyfriend, we had taken a break. We were having rocky times, so we took a couple weeks off. And we were supposed to talk that upcoming Saturday, and Friday night, he died of a drug overdose in the arms of another woman. I never got any closure on that. It was this weird kind of, just, he was gone. So I was working as an exotic dancer, although there was nothing exotic about it, in the Valley at a bar called The Classy Lady, which was not appropriately named. It was your typical Valley bar, and let's just say I was not your typical Valley girl. I had very short hair, almost shaved head. I have tattoos. In fact, I have a tattoo on my head. And one day I was at the backstage, this tiny, tiny little stage. It was probably the size of a kitchen table. And it was also a day shift, and day shifts are like the most depressing at a strip club. I mean, I know the classic cliche is like they put the ugly dancers on day shift, but I mean, the clientele is really depressing on a day shift. Overweight, beer-bellied, pale, like they had never seen the sun despite living in the Valley, because, you know, it's normally people who are drinking at 3 o'clock in the afternoon pretty much every day. And so I'm bored out of my mind and dancing for no money, and no one's even looking at me. And I look up, and this man walks in, African-American, chin-length dreads, and he's super cute and totally different than anyone else in this bar. And then he looks up and looks at me and smiles like the biggest, gentle, and happy smile I've ever seen in my whole life. And he goes to get a beer, and then he actually comes over to the backstage where no one ever goes, and he comes to talk to me. He has this just playful, giggly way of talking, and it's adorable. And then I notice that he has the most incredible tattoos on his hands. They're these geometric designs, and he told me about them, that there were traditional Samoan hand tap tattoos. And his name was Peitama, which means loyal son in Samoan. I really pursued him, and so I went to the tattoo shop. He had given me his card under the guise that I was interested in this tattoo, which I was, but I was also more interested in possibly dating him. So I went and I brought my friend for backup, And that initial meeting was very unsuccessful, but I still pursued him for probably close to 6 months. And then eventually I got him to go out for a drink with me and we kissed, but he didn't pursue any other sexual contact that first time. I was a little confused by that. You know, if you get the chance to go there with a stripper, you better go there. But I was also really kind of relieved. I was struggling with my own sexual identity. I had come out when I was 21. And I had been in a relationship with a woman and lived with her, but I was really having a hard time figuring out how to be gay in LA in particular. The women there are so soft. We did eventually become a couple. We would spend every night together, and it was just really comfortable and super easy. Then a few months later, I finally nailed down the artist who does the actual traditional hand-tapped tattoos and set up an appointment for my tattoo. The artist holds this piece of bamboo, and then strapped to the piece of bamboo is a comb made out of bones. And then the artist dips the comb into ink and then basically hammers the ink into your body. I think about it now and I'm like, what was I thinking? But it was also because the design process is really interesting. Like, you basically have a conversation with the artist and they design it based on your path. And so it's very much a spiritual kind of designing process. You ran the design by me and it was a traditional body stripe designed to go from my armpit to my ankle. And we start tattooing me in this insanely ritualistic and painful process. It's essentially like being stabbed over and over. And this tattoo is going all the way from my armpit to my ankle. And I was like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to finish that. I mean, it was so excruciatingly painful. But the whole time, Peitama would keep his hands on me and even when I wanted to jump up and scream running out of the room from pain, his hand would just, you know, calm me down and keep me grounded and soothe me. So they finished the tattoo to my ankle. And normally the tattoo would continue onto my foot. But when we got to my ankle, Peitama said, we don't want to finish it onto your foot because you're not where you're supposed to be yet for life. Tattooing my foot would ground me in whatever moment I was in, and I was a coke addict, and I mean a large amount of cocaine. I was probably doing $500 a week of cocaine at that point. We ended up breaking up after probably about a year. You know, part of that was the fact that I'm gay, and so probably, you know, that impacted it. But we stayed friends pretty instantly, stayed close friends. And I mean, I still like would call him after a heartbreak or after a breakup and talk to him and say, you know, am I a bad girlfriend? Like, what is wrong with me? And, you know, he would always just say, no, it's just not your right time yet. You're just not ready yet. I was a very functional addict. You know, I knew I wanted to get a PhD and I got accepted to LSU, which was one of my top choices. And so they admitted me and gave me like a full ride and this extra stipend. And I moved to Louisiana 2 weeks before Katrina hit. So after Katrina, I left a voicemail for Peitama. And he never returned it. And then I called him again, and his phone was disconnected. And I called over and over, knowing that sometimes he would let his phone bill lapse. And then I finally tried him again out of the blue, and he answered. And he told me that he had been in the hospital for over a month. He was 33 at that point, and that he had had a stroke and complete kidney failure. He eventually told me that he needed a kidney transplant. And so, you know, kind of joking, I was like, oh, you know, you can have one of mine. I was like, I have two, you know, and he kind of laughed it off. And I was not really serious. I knew he had a lot of friends and he had a brother and a mother. So I was like, well, someone else will be a match and everything will be fine. I didn't really think about my drug addiction when I said you can have one of mine, but I ended up getting clean about 2 years into my PhD program, and he still hadn't gotten a kidney. And I realized that it was getting a little bit more desperate, and I had gotten clean, so I knew that like the last barrier to me donating was gone. And so I called him up and I said, I'm ready to get tested, you know, to see if I'm a match. What do I do? There was no one else in his life offering up to even get tested. So we had them like FedEx my blood to the transplant team, like 36 vials of blood. And a couple weeks later, the coordinator called me. I was a 5 out of 6 possibility of tissue matching, and that's the most I can be without being a relative. So I was a match. I was pretty shocked, but I didn't have any hesitation about donating. I don't know if I have some kind of martyr complex or whatever, but I'm not that good of a person or anything. You know, I'm just as selfish as anyone else, but I just felt like if I can give as much as I can give, I will do that. I didn't want him to go away. Like, so many people close to me had died, and if I could prevent another person from going, I would. Little itch of an idea, like, oh, this means I can't ever relapse again. It became very clear to me that if I relapsed, my remaining kidney would not survive and that I would not live. That was the only little bit of hesitation. Like, oh no, I can't relapse ever again. So I finished out the semester and flew out to LA to donate my kidney. And at that point, it started to hit me that I was about to have major surgery. So I started watching Discovery Health Channel for some stupid reason, a show called Trauma Life in the ER. And that is not a good idea when you're about to have surgery. And everyone kept dying on the show. And I kept watching it because I kept expecting like a normal TV show like resolves itself, like the drama happens and then it's a resolution. But this show is a reality TV show, so like it doesn't resolve itself. The resolution is the death. And so I started like really getting scared, like freaking out. And I just walked out the front door onto the beach and literally kneeled down and just bawled my eyes out for like 2 hours. I was like, oh my God, it might not work and he might die in it and I might die and I am so terrified. We showed up that day of the transplant and both Peyton and I were just kind of staring off into space, like terrified on our minds, and neither of us knew what to say to each other. And he was like, I have a gift for you. And he gave me this like heart lock. It's like a little lock and it's a heart. He didn't really say anything about it. He was like, I got you this. We decided that we were going to dream of dolphins during the transplant. So the last thing I saw was the anesthesiologist saying, you can dream of dolphins now. But I didn't dream of dolphins. I, in fact, dreamt of cheeseburgers and milkshakes. I woke up in the most excruciating pain I've ever felt in my entire life. I thought that I was very strong because I have this extremely painful tattoo experience, but it turns out that donating an organ hurts a little bit more than that. He came out of surgery and the kidney ended up pinking up, which is what you want, but my body was not reacting at all well to the surgery. I was literally crying in pain. Compared to when I got the tattoo, which was such a communal experience, the transplant was so completely lonely. I didn't see Paitama until day 4. He was on a different floor, and they wheeled me down, and we were both still on morphine, so we just kind of stared at each other for a while. And I asked him if he had dreamt of dolphins. And he said, "No, I dreamt of cheeseburgers." And I was like, "I dreamt of cheeseburgers too." I couldn't believe it. So I guess we were connected through the cheeseburgers. I stayed in LA for about 2 weeks, and he was getting better. And he said at that point, no matter what happens, just this last 2 weeks of not being on dialysis has been worth it. It was weird to hear him say that because I was like, well, what's going to happen? Nothing's going to happen. Everything's going to be fine. You're going to live forever. And then it was late July, and my ER nurse friend, Kristen, called me and said that Paitama had come into the ER. He woke up that morning in a pool of blood and that he had to have a blood transfusion. She didn't really make it seem like it was a big deal. She did say, "This is serious," but she didn't say, like, how serious it was. And my phone rang, and I thought it was him. I mean, it was his phone number. And I was like, "You just can't stay away from those nurses, can you?" And it was his mom. And she told me that he had lost the kidney, and he was in a coma. I asked her to, like, call me every day and give me updates, and she didn't. Eventually, she answered the phone, and she said that he was still intubated, but he was out of the coma, and that he couldn't talk to me, but I could talk to him, and he could listen. So she was going to put the phone up to his ear. And so I said, "Don't worry about the kidney, and we'll get you another kidney, and you just need to get better because I love you." She said, "Call back on Saturday." And so I called back on Saturday, and she said that he had another turn for the worse and that he was in a coma again. And then the next day, he died. I felt extreme loss in my body. I was like, oh, like I had been hit by a truck. I tried everything I could, and it didn't work to save his life. It's the crappiest story because when I tell people, "Oh, I donated my kidney," they're like, "Oh, that's so amazing." And then they always ask, "How is the recipient doing?" And that is just a very awkward conversation. The story is not supposed to end like that, right? It's supposed to end with everyone living happily ever after. I still have his phone number in my phone, and I've changed phones, I mean, like 4 or 5 times since then. I've changed phone numbers, and I still programmed his phone number in my new phone. I wanted him to answer and be like, "Good morning, sunshine," because he would always answer the phone that way, even if it was like midnight. I often think about that thing that he said at the end of our tattoo. "You're not where you're supposed to be yet. You have to get to where you're going, and then I'll finish your tattoo." And in terms of my own life and my own path, I feel like I am where I'm supposed to be going. I have a tenure track job in the Bay Area, which was my dream always. I have a community of friends. I'm not on drugs anymore. I've figured out that I'm a lesbian. I've committed finally to my sexual identity, and I'm an adult. Students come to me for advice. Like, I'm actually someone who signs papers, but I still have a mohawk, and I still would actually love to do burlesque, but I can't because my students would see me. So I haven't totally converted, but I feel like in terms of my own path, I am in a place where I could finish my tattoo. But, you know, we had always planned to go to New Zealand together to get it finished after the transplant. And I can't imagine completing this process without him. So maybe it's supposed to be unfinished forever. I never felt like I had just given up my kidney for nothing. I wish I could donate again, despite the pain and despite not being able to take Advil. I would do it a million times over if I could. For a complete stranger, and I would do it for a friend. I don't understand why you're not doing it. And I'm not trying to judge all the world, But I'm like, there's only 93,000 people on the list. So like, if only 93,000 people did that, which is only a small fraction of the amount of people in the world, like, I feel like there should be 93,000 people who would donate.
That was Cora Layton with an ethical challenge for all of us. Why am I not giving up a kidney to save someone's life? And why aren't you, assuming that most of you have not? Cora says she'd give a kidney not just to a friend, but even to a stranger if she could donate again, which of course she can't. But there's a growing number of people who can and who do give kidneys to strangers. There's a website called matchingdonors.com designed to match volunteer donors with potential recipients. It's like a dating site for kidney donations. And there are more than 13,000 people on this site right now who are offering up a kidney to someone who needs it. Why? Or maybe more to the point, why not give a kidney to a stranger? Many of us would risk our lives to try to save someone in an emergency, I think. We might cross a highway to help a victim in a car crash, or jump in the water to prevent someone from drowning. And here's the thing. All of those things are far more dangerous than giving up a kidney. One study actually shows that kidney donors live longer than the rest of us. Of course, part of that is that they have to be healthy to begin with, or they can't donate. And they're also more likely to stay healthy and to take care of themselves, perhaps because they've given up a kidney. But some people suggest that the very act of giving also prolongs their life. Other studies have shown that giving, not just kidneys, but all forms of charitable giving, makes us both happier and healthier. Whatever the reason, the fact is that kidney donors don't die sooner than the rest of us, and they may even live longer. But do they live as well? Cora says that in her case, the only two effects of having one kidney are that she drinks a lot of water to keep her remaining kidney healthy, and that she can't take ibuprofen products. Other than that, it has not affected her life in any physical way since she recovered from the surgery. 9 people die each day in the U.S. waiting for a kidney transplant. That's according to the National Kidney Foundation's number from 2013. And the 93,000 people Cora referred to waiting for a kidney has actually gone up to 100,000 in the U.S. alone. So why not give? Personally, I've experienced a shift in my attitude. Some years ago, when stranger donations first became a thing, it seemed totally nuts to me. I thought a person would have to suffer from a severe martyr complex or some more serious form of mental illness to even consider it. Larissa McFarquhar wrote a great piece in The New Yorker in 2009 about kidney donations to strangers, and it showed that many people reacted the same way, suspecting that the donors were nuts, almost villainizing them in some cases. And it's important to note that donors cannot be compensated because it's illegal to sell organs. In other words, they're not doing it for the money. But as I learned more about kidney transplants, I went from thinking that stranger donations were crazy to thinking that they were admirable, generally speaking. Every case is different, of course. But I still never considered that it was something I should do. Not until now, anyway. I suddenly find myself without a real good argument as to why I'm not doing it. Okay, there's a rational fear of the surgery, the pain and the hassle of it, the small risk, 3 in 10,000 die. It's a very small percentage, but it's there. There's an irrational fear that it'll somehow put me at risk longer term. Irrational because all studies show the contrary. There's a question of, you know, what if my son or someone else close to me needed a kidney and I'd already given it to a stranger? And then there's a strong feeling of, ugh, I just can't be bothered. Please don't make me think about it. Please don't show me all those young people living in agony, facing death, whose lives I could be saving by giving up something that I can apparently live very well without. Just leave me alone about it already. That's the prevailing feeling, and that may be the number one reason why we don't do more for others in many aspects of life. But who knows? Maybe that'll shift for me too, as it has for a growing number of people who are signing on for this. I'd love to hear what you think. I made a post on our Facebook page last week asking if anyone would give up a kidney to save a stranger or a friend. And often when I do these production-related polls, I get 50 or 60 responses. In this case, I got none. Perhaps many of you feel, as I do, that it's just something you'd rather not think about. Something you don't want to do, but can't make a solid case against. Or do you think that organ transplants are tantamount to playing God and are wrong for that reason? Is there something unnerving and unnatural about the way we intervene to save life? If you do have something to say on this topic, you can comment at kcrw.com/strangers. And in any case, join our community on Facebook. I promise I won't make you give up an organ or shame you for not. How could I? Facebook is also a great way to find out about our events, like our next Strangers No More party on May 21st in LA. On my site, storycentral.org, you can find a link to the Facebook page and to our iTunes page and to my Twitter account, at Leah Tao, and you can sign up for our mailing list and get direct news in your inbox about our events and everything we have going on. That's storycentral.org. The mailing list is powered by MailChimp, who is also the launch sponsor of Radiotopia from PRX, our new collective of the best story-driven radio shows on the planet. One Radiotopia partner is the new podcast, Fugitive Waves, from the Kitchen Sisters. If you don't know them, you really should. Here's a clip from their new episode.
You'd see like Pete Townsend coming through, or Ray Davis, or Keith, or Bowie.
Any band that was worth its salt had to play there. Till you ticked off that one on your itinerary, you hadn't really arrived.
You can find all Radiotopia shows at radiotopia.fm and in iTunes. And so long as you're there, if you like this show, please give it a good rating and tell your friends. Strangers is also a part of KCRW's Independent Producer Project, and support for that excellent initiative comes from the Annenberg Foundation, the Goldhirsch Foundation, and the Roth Family Foundation. Strangers is supported by the Leon Lowenstein Foundation, the Lucius and Eva Eastman Fund, and Radiotopia is supported by the Knight Foundation. Big thanks to Mike Dodge Weisskopf, Louisa Beck, Kristen Carty, J.C. Swadok, and Cora Layton for telling her story. Her website is corathepreformer.com. If you have a story to tell, email me at strangers@kcrw.com. I'm Leah Tao. Until next time, don't be a stranger.
Radiotopia.